Good morning. Let me call the City of Mesa study session of December 13th, 2007 to order. We have 9 items. Let me first excuse Councilmember Wayland from the meeting this morning. And I'd like to begin with the review of the items that will be on the December 17th, 2007 meeting. If you want to find those in your packet, we'll go through it. Page 1 is the welcome introductions. Page 2, liquor license applications, contracts, public hearing. Vice Mayor.
It's just a silly question. I don't know what a craft brewer's guild is. I just was curious. Does anybody know what that is?
When you're brewing beer, it's a real craft, is what
I thought. Is that what it is? Okay.
I didn't look it up either, but I assume
that's... Oh, she doesn't know either. Okay, so we don't know. All right.
All right. Have to show up to find out, I guess. Page 3. More contracts. Vice Mayor.
Question on 5E, which is the ultra-thin bonded wearing course. We've had this now for a little while. How's it working, Lenny? This is... this is the ultra-thin bond wearing material. Had a couple of years now.
That's correct, Vice Mayor. It's working out excellent. We've had some good service life out of the product. We put some here on First Ave, if you remember, 2 years ago in university, and we are continuing to use that product. And we haven't seen the reflective cracking, potholes haven't appeared. It was nice not to come down to First Street this last rainstorm and send crews down your patch in the road, so it's held up well.
So your expectations are being met and maybe exceeded?
Yes, yes. We were hoping to get... We put them on some pretty rough streets, near First Avenue and also University. We're hoping to get 5 years out of them. It looks like it's holding up well.
Okay, thank you.
This is the material contract only for the purchase of the material, not applying it?
That's correct. This is material only, Mayor.
So we can leave it on?
That's correct.
All right. And I have a question on 5C, on the fire apparatus. I didn't quite understand what the page was in our packet that indicated that the bid was $36,851. It kind of was a standalone sheet. Do you have the same information we have?
Yeah, I do. Mayor and members of council, that five-year purchase agreement with Pierce Manufacturing and First In, that $37,000 was a savings on parts only. It had nothing to do with the purchase of actual apparatus. And the numbers that I show here on estimates are approximately, with the contract, approximate savings of $1,000,003 for apparatus purchase, and about...
I picked up all that in the background information. I was just surprised. It was a sole source, and the description of the total net bid is the savings per year then? Is that what you were trying to calculate on that?
Yeah, and I'll let Ed Quedens add to that comment as well.
I think I'm going to, I wasn't aware or I didn't see that page, so we'll get that clarified before Monday.
I think you can probably take it out.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's page 3. Vice Mayor.
Page 4.
All right.
I have a question on the CAP water treatment reservoir modifications. It said in the backup material that currently you're using the one reservoir when the other one can't be used. Sometimes you use the other one. So what happens now if one needs to be out of service for some reason? Now how do you handle that?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, actually this project gives us a lot more flexibility than we have right now. What we can do right now with this project is we'll be able to either operate with the water flowing through one reservoir and then into the next one, or we can separate them and have water flow into each at the same time, or we can isolate one and operate without the other one. So this actually gives us more flexibility.
All right, thank you.
Follow up on that. How does that help with the water contact with the chlorine by doing what you're doing? That's the reason for this whole process.
Yes, sir, that's why we're doing it. By allowing the water to flow first into one reservoir and then into the second reservoir, it gives us a longer time in the basins before it gets to the distribution system, and that longer time allows the chlorine to be in contact with the water a longer time and kill more of the bacteria that may be present. So it's a matter of time, contact time with the chlorine itself before it gets into the distribution system.
Okay, so you're operating them in a series and you put the chlorine in the...
Ahead of the reservoirs.
Okay, and all right, I think I understand.
Is it?
Yeah. So you want more contact with chlorine, but you want less contact with standing water in the pipe systems, because that's another issue.
Right, that's disinfection byproducts. That's a whole different issue.
Okay, all right. Any other questions on page 4? All right, page 5. 6B, one of my favorites. Let's take it off consent, please.
Yes, Mayor. This is an introduction of an ordinance for a freeway sign for Fiesta Mall. If you've looked at the introduction material on that, you'll see it has five conditions listed, five stipulations, the last one of which deals with the height, and it has a blank in it on that height. You need to take a little time this morning and maybe on Monday night, depending on how far we get this morning, to talk about that and come up with a height to put in there for this particular sign. Give you a little background. This is on the north side of the 60, just west of Alma School, again, for Fiesta Mall. We have some pictures we can put up to show some of the simulations of the heights. The applicant is asking for 94 feet of height, what they originally submitted. When we look at that and with the photo simulations, the sign is just barely visible above the berm and the trees. One of the requirements of the guidelines for these signs is that they're supposed to be visible enough so that a driver on that side of the freeway can see the sign, recognize that's where they want to go, make the lane change, and get to the exit easily. We're concerned that the sign is just so barely visible that it could cause more harm than it helps by being recognized at the last minute, just as people are arriving at that exit ramp and not really being able to make that safe decision to get off the freeway. So based on that concern at the Planning and Zoning Board, and that staff report, staff recommended that it actually be lowered to something around 80 feet, more consistent with other signs we've approved recently along the US 60. So then we don't have that concern about being causing a problem instead of helping with that identification. At the P&Z board meeting, or that the day of the meeting, the applicant came forward with the idea that maybe it could go up to 104 feet and be a little bit more visible, and maybe that would be enough then to get over staff's concerns. The Planning and Zoning Board discussed those various options at length, including even going taller to make sure it really was visible. A motion was made by the P&Z board for approval at the 104 feet. We had six members there, and that got a 3-3 draw. A motion was then made to approve it at the 94 feet, and that was denied 4-2, and that's where they left it at that point. Given the overall area and some of the other heights in the area, staff does not really have a problem going taller either. We do have the concern about the 94 feet, and so that's where we are today, needing to determine what height we really want to put in here. The applicant, since the P&Z board meeting, has really pulled that 104 feet off the table and really wants to concentrate on the 94 feet as the appropriate height for the sign. Again, we have some photo sims we can put up on the Elmo if you'd like to see those.
Why don't you put them up? Let's take a look at what we're talking about here. And this is just an introduction, so I'll let it go in for introduction and whatever we do.
It's Jennifer Gnifke of our planning staff. She's been the planner on this case, and she's got those, and she's put them up.
John, if 94 feet is very visible, what is 80 feet?
94 feet is just barely visible. 80, you can't see at all coming headed westbound.
And that was staff's recommendation?
Coming, right, headed westbound. Coming eastbound, it's all very visible. 40 feet is very visible headed eastbound. It's the westbound that we're concerned about.
But so 80 really doesn't
80
help
doesn't
at
do
all.
Anything for the westbound.
And 94 barely makes it visible. And then the question is, I thought maybe there was a gap in the trees or something at 80 that wasn't at 94.
And the ordinance is visible from both sides of the freeway?
It's on the side of the freeway that the sign is on and the exit that it's on. So it's the main thing is for the westbound traffic is what we're really trying to capture and their visibility so they can see to get off on that side.
So if you just take down the Hilton or something, they're fine?
It's the berm. It's the berm in there that was put in.
Vice Mayor.
Okay, so when the freeway was constructed, the freeway was much lower in terms of grade when Fiesta Mall was built. So now it's been bermed up, and so now you can't see them all. So they're going for a sign, but the ordinance that we put into place was our thought that it would be for the people who were on that side of the road. But my understanding is that the people who own the mall are more concerned with the people who are coming in the other direction seeing the sign. Would that be a fair assessment of it?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, I don't think I've heard them say that. Certainly, again, the eastbound traffic, the sign is very visible even at 40 or 50 feet. There are no obstructions going that way. It's the westbound traffic on the same side that has the difficulty seeing the sign.
Okay, so why would you then worry about approving an 80-foot sign? Well, never mind. Go ahead. Let's see the signs.
So here is the 94-foot, and Jennifer, if you can point out it's very hard to see. It's pretty small sign.
Yeah.
John, do you have multiple copies of that?
We didn't.
At what distance is this?
That's the 90-foot high sign, and you can see where you are. You're on the ramp. You're on the ramp this place. Jennifer, slide it over so you can see the one on the other side. Here, you're just getting on the ramp at this point. And
there you go.
Okay, you're still not going to get probably close enough because it's very small and very hard to see. You will have copies of these in your packet when you get your full packet, and we can pass these around after we've shown each one. Jennifer, can you point to the sign out there in that particular picture?
There's actually another updated photo as well that the applicant provided.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
Just to clarify, this is getting on the ramp heading
west.
Heading west, and which ramp is it?
It's the one for Alma School.
So this is Alma School on ramp heading west.
All right.
Off ramp.
Right. Getting off onto Alma School.
Off ramp.
Right.
West location. Okay.
And so there you can see it in this particular picture. Jennifer pointed out right there, but here you're well on the ramp by the time you can really see it.
John?
Yes.
Okay, so let me just get myself oriented. I'm headed westbound on the US 60.
Yes.
I'm on the off ramp for Alma School.
Right.
To see that?
Right.
Well, if I'm on the off ramp, won't I have just seen the mall from being up on Alma School Road?
You're on the freeway. You're getting off the freeway onto Alma School, headed west. You haven't been on Alma School yet. You haven't gotten to Alma School
yet. Okay. Okay. So you're now you are east of Alma School Road.
Right. Headed west.
Headed west.
That's right.
Okay, so you're headed west, you're east of Alma School Road.
Right.
And where am I at this moment when I'm seeing this sign? Am I at the place where I'd have to get over right now in order to get off at Alma School?
You're already past that point. You're on the ramp at this point.
Next to the hill. The hill is probably immediately on your right.
Yeah, but if you're already on the off ramp, what do you...
The sign isn't good. Good.
Yeah, yeah.
Go back to the one where you had to make your decision.
Saying if you're on the off ramp, you already knew you were getting off.
No, I don't even see it.
Jennifer, can you point what little bit you can see of it on here? No, the crane, the highest it would go is this height. So this is the highest that we've gotten off the
What's the sign look like when you're right next to it, just looking to your right?
Mayor, I'm not sure we have one for westbound, and you can look in that way. I'm not
east,
think we have
west,
that. We have the eastbound
right.
sign so that we can
look. That's where the 40 or 80, anything works.
Right.
All right. Because something on signage has to do with recognizing where it is. If you drive up and down there and you see the sign every day, whether you see it quarter mile or a half a mile or 3 miles in advance, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference as long as there's a sign there that gives it good visibility. But
so here's the 90-foot sign for eastbound traffic. Can you point to it, Jennifer?
Right above that little pole. Right
there.
That's way high.
Yeah.
All right.
Can you go back to the other picture, Jennifer, so we can see it in the context there? Thank you.
And if you're coming eastbound and you go under Alma School, do you have any views on what the sign would look like from an eastbound direction?
This is eastbound.
Oh, going east.
Going west after you've gone under Alma School?
Right.
No, I don't believe we did. There you go.
But that's on which side of Alma School? East of Alma School
west.
Still? That's west of Alma School? So is that going?
Going westbound, just past
Alma
School.
Alma School Road, westbound. And that's, what's 80Z?
80 feet.
80 feet.
Jennifer, point out the sign, please.
Under the tree.
Right there.
The bottom line is tree to tree. You're not going to see it in the distance. You're going to see it as you pass it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you probably catch it as you get up more into it, but in the distance, you're just not going to see it.
Okay, so what's the council's height suggestion here? It's a fill-in-the-blank study session.
I know. We've never done that before.
We have a 3-3. We got a 4-2 recommendation from P&Z, so they're pretty...
Yeah, and I understand the 4-2 was because the people didn't want to vote for 94 because they really preferred 110 because it wasn't so.
4-2 was on the.
Was on the 94.
On the 94.
Yeah.
103 was a 3-3.
Yeah. I guess the 94 seems to be a safety problem in my mind, and you can't really see it. And if you do see it, you're going to try to get over too fast. So to me, it's either the 80 or the 110. I'd rather fill it in at 110, and then if it gets voted down, we can bring it back at 80 another time. I mean, to me, it's just we're going to have to make a decision, and we have to have one or the other. And I think the applicant would probably prefer 110 over 80.
Well, the applicant want to weigh in this morning?
If they're happy with 94, I'll go with 94. But
we are.
Okay. But staff's not.
I think they realize they have to get a bigger crane just to set it, too.
Mayor, council, I guess the first thing I would say is, with all due respect to your guidelines, when you did your guidelines, I think that you, when staff did them, they had in mind a flat stretch of freeway so that you could easily see from either direction the property that you were going to put the sign on. And your guideline worked okay at Superstition Springs. We just got an approval for a freeway sign there because you can see the mall from both directions fairly well. In this location, because of, number one, the overpass, the freeway is depressed, and the Alma School overpass precludes vision to the mall. The second factor we have here is when ADOT rebuilt the freeway, they put that big berm, that landscape berm, so that as you're between Alma School and Longmore and you look toward the mall, you can't see the mall anymore either. So we've taken a lot of looks at where to site the sign and how high to make the sign. And the 94-foot sign, you do get some visibility of the sign as you're traveling westbound on the freeway before you make the exit, but we believe it's just as important after you go under that Alma School. You've already missed the exit, that's true, but you will get to see that sign. The other thing that's a little bit misleading, due to safety, when you take these photos, you have to be all the way over on the right shoulder taking the photos, unless you're going to close the freeway down and let us move into each lane and take photos. As you move to the left, particularly on the 94-foot sign, obviously the visibility gets better because you get further away from that immediate berm and the wall right next to you. I'll put this one back up here. So again, the sign is right here. Remember, we are in the far right-hand lane just after you pass going westbound under the Alma School overpass. If you were to move into the travel lane, you can see it better. Even better, lanes 2, 3, 4, and into the HOV lane. So there is definitely visibility to the sign. True, you've missed the opportunity to exit at Alma School, but you go down to Dobson and you come back around. The visibility for the 94-foot sign is better than the 80-foot sign for that reason. That's why we're asking for 94. We think it works well for us.
Okay. Let me go ahead and hear from everybody so we know what your thought is. Tom, you're 94. All right. Scott?
I'll support 94 with Tom's recommendation. I think the 94-foot sign does give some visibility. And the only person that's going to see this particular view is the person whose tire just blew out, and they're changing it. I think as you get to the farther away from that hill, you're going to see more of that sign. Might have to skip an exit, go to the next one. But you know, I see some of this sign, and I think, and it's a two-dimensional picture, makes it hard to see, but as we see this in real life, I think it's going to give you some visibility, and I disagree with you. I think the regulation was, as it states, says it should be, have some level of visibility. So this gives at least some level of visibility. It does keep it quite flexible.
Fair enough.
So I will support the 90 feet.
94?
94.
Okay.
And 6 inches.
Based on what we've listened to, I think the 94 would probably be appropriate. My curiosity is,
the location of the sign where you're fighting the overpass, I would have thought it would be better right at Alma School where you can see from both directions where you're not fighting the overpass, but that's just a question in my mind.
Yes, Mayor, Councilmember Jones, there's a reason for the location as well, and I'll put a site plan up here. And
how do you zoom, need to zoom out? It out, yeah.
Go more wide. There you go. The location that we're proposing is right here along the Ring Road. You recall that right here there's a retention basin for the site. The opportunity to move the sign this direction, we actually did some earlier photo simulations with the sign in this area. You didn't get much more, maybe a foot or two of additional visibility. And then I should back up a step. When we acquired the Macy's building, which we've since torn down and are about to rebuild for our mini majors, we now own this entire portion of the property. We have an opportunity to bring some redevelopment to this area right along Alma School.
And so you don't want to hinder that development.
Correct. If we site the sign anywhere down in here, it's going to limit what we can do. We've got opportunities potentially for a theater, for a hotel, maybe other retail down in this area. We want to keep that sign a little bit further over. So the additional visibility was not enough to outweigh the opportunity for future redevelopment, in our opinion.
Okay. For me personally, I thought you get closer to the intersection, you get greater visibility, but I see your concern about development. But
yes.
Okay.
All right. Vice Mayor?
Yeah, I support the 94 feet. The reason for the sign ordinance, one of the major reasons we changed the sign ordinance was because of what had happened to Fiesta Mall as a result of the redesign of the freeway. It made you invisible, whereas when you had constructed there, you were very, very visible. So I think your analysis there of the redevelopment along the front parcel is also the correct analysis. I think that will help them all. So I'll support it. Thank you.
Sure. They don't actually need you, but what's your
Wow.
I guess my concern here is that I think we're abrogating the analysis to the applicants and not to the staff. You know, the issue was 94 feet, and I think they've all now admitted that the 94 feet probably has nothing to do with the traffic that is west or east of Alma School Road. You're probably not going to see anything. I don't care if it's 80 feet, 94 feet, 104 feet, whatever. You're probably not going to see hardly anything. So it's really as you're westbound after you've come under the freeway. So I guess I would rather see staff's opinion if that's what we're really saying as to whether or not 80 feet, 94 feet, 70 feet, 110 feet, what's the right height. And I think everybody's agreed that you can see it pretty well going eastbound no matter what size it is. So I'm just concerned that we're aggregating and jumping on this bandwagon of letting the applicant do the analysis for letting the staff do the analysis because we've changed the criteria sitting right here. That's my statement.
Okay, it looks like the 94 feet will be the fill in the blank. I have always supported just keeping sign heights at 20 feet and not exceeding that limit. So I'll be voting against it when it does come up. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we are on page six. I guess five, six. Is item 6D... What's the name of the bank that's being constructed? And I may be a stockholder in that Gateway Bank.
Mayor, I'll have to double check. It is a new bank that's recently been created.
Is it called a Gateway Bank?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Does that constitute a conflict if you're a stockholder?
Mayor, if I recall correctly, the statute says remote interest is if you own less than 3% of the stock in an entity.
Then you're a remote interest?
Yes. If you own more than 3%, then it would be a conflict.
All right. Would you check that out? I do own less than 3%. So.
I will.
All right. Let's leave it on until we hear differently. Vice Mayor?
Mayor, I'll state that I have that same concern. So if you would let me know, too. Thank you.
Okay. Page 6, resolutions. Page 7, Tom?
Mike's not here, but I know he's very involved with prehab, and he normally, I'm just looking at 7E. It's probably one that needs to be taken off for his conflict reason.
Okay. I agree.
He may have a different opinion when he gets here, but I think
we'll inquire. 7G and 7H, one specifies the date and the other one specifies the dollars. Those actually had to be presented separately.
Mayor, we actually are looking at this, and we may be able to combine these for Monday. So
it doesn't make any difference. I just thought it was unusual.
No, we did too, and so we caught that, and we may be combining those by the time you see them on Monday.
All right. The call for the election, 7I, is off consent. The reason for that? Okay. All right. That's a good reason. Any other discussion on that item then? What's the nature of your conflict on that one?
I think that we have two contracts with the City of Mesa right now that we've done planning studies for, the transportation projects, and if the election passes, then those projects might go into design and we would be doing the design.
Okay. All right. That's page 7. Page 8. The 8D, which is the pawn shop, is on with a denial, which is a little unusual. So would the vote be to confirm PNZ's denial, or would you vote in favor of the recommendation? How is that going to be stated?
That's one of the reasons this is not on consent. In addition to that, we believe we'll have people here to talk about it, but to clarify a motion, we thought it would be beneficial to have it off consent so that a specific motion could be made to approve or deny.
Okay.
But because, the Mayor, the way it's written, if it were to stay on consent and get approved, it would be
denied.
No, it'd be for it.
Yeah, we could just see what happens.
All right.
Well, still fairly comfortable there will be speakers.
Okay. All right. It's,
I guarantee it.
Currently not on the consent agenda. So. Right.
Right, well, I would have removed it from consent, Mayor, had it been on. So.
Right. Well, but okay. That's page 8, page 9. On item number 11, the Public Safety Committee and the Photo Safety Enforcement, is there a statute or a provision to allow non-sworn officers to man the vans under the contract and issue tickets? Has that been clarified, or is that still challengeable?
Mayor, I have not looked at the statute, so I can't tell you as we sit here today. But
letter came across my desk questioning that, whether, I know we were able to do it with parking enforcement because we actually got something through the legislature, but I didn't know if other cities had already faced that with non-sworn officers.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of council. I don't believe so, but I'm going to let the vendor and Commander Latancio speak to this issue.
Okay. Because I think the recommendation coming forward is several of the vans would be staffed by vendor employees and not sworn officers. Is that?
That is correct, sir. Yes.
Right.
And this is a model that's being followed by other cities. And
correct, Mayor and Council. Currently, our staff man the vans for the Phoenix program and for the Scottsdale program and for the Avondale program, and I believe also the Tucson program. And private staff have manned photo enforcement vans since 1996.
Has it been challenged and upheld? Has there been any court?
I don't believe it's ever become an issue.
But Mayor and Commander, can you explain though that how this has actually been reviewed later before the citation is actually issued? Because I think isn't that the key before? Because even today, the individuals that are in the vans, they're not necessarily sworn officers, correct?
Correct.
So why don't you explain the process from the van to the time it gets issued as a citation?
What happens, currently we have civilians in the mobile speed vans that are deployed. when the ticket gets captured, it gets sent over to ATS. That gets reviewed to make sure that the person picture is there.
What's ATS again?
Oh, American Traffic Solutions. That's our vendor.
Okay.
First it gets sent to our vendor. They review it, and then they send it to us. Then we have a sworn officer that reviews that photo to make sure everything matches up with the gender of the person that's in the picture, to make sure that all matches before we actually issue a citation out. Then after that sworn officer agrees to that, then that ticket gets issued.
All right, and how does the, and that has, if somebody goes to traffic court and says there wasn't an officer, it was a guy in a van and he didn't have the ability to do that, do we have statutes or something that says, yes, you do, you can run enforcement vans and you don't have to have a police officer or a sworn personnel there?
There is a state statute that allows the chief of police to authorize an agent to issue a citation. So, in fact, the chief of police could authorize ATS to actually issue the citations, even though we do not.
But you don't issue the citation, you just take the photo. So I'm trying to figure out what the connection is there and make sure we're fine to go forward. I like the program. I don't want police officers in vans. I think it's a waste of effort. So I like what you're doing.
We believe it is. There have been thousands of cases held since 1996 in which this mechanism has been used, and there hasn't been any issue.
Okay. All right. Then I'll try not to make it one. Tom?
I would also point out that a lot of times with traffic accidents, the police officer who arrives at the scene didn't witness the accident, and based upon the statements made by civilians, he'll issue a citation for an unsafe lane change or for speeding or other things. So it's who issues the citation is probably what's required, and I think it has to come from us, but it doesn't mean that the person who witnessed it has to be a police officer.
Good point. Right, Kyle?
Along the same line, it's data collection, just like your red light camera. You don't have an officer there taking the pictures, but they take the data that's collected and evaluate it an issue with what they have available.
Okay. Appreciate the information. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, that's page 9. And that's it. Anything we missed? Okay. Let's go back to item number 2. Here a presentation to discuss the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan.
Good morning, Mayor, members of the council. I'm Scott Rigby, project manager for Gateway Area, along with Bill Jabjiniak, our new economic development director, all the way to the far right, Mark McLaren from HDR, you've heard from before, and Jeff Kleiman, who is with IMG, that is doing discussions about our airport opportunities, along with financial opportunities. Just want to take a minute and kind of talk a little bit about, we were here 2 weeks ago, unveiling generally 3 land use plans. We took some feedback from you. We've incorporated those comments to you. We understand we're throwing a lot of information at you in a short amount of time, but the goal is to continue to push towards that May decision point where we'll bring it for final action. There's 3 things we really want to focus on today and talk about and how they interrelate, and so we can, as we present to you, that message comes across and we get some feedback from you. First is, number one is the airport and how critical that is. We have Jeff from IMG who wrote an excellent airport opportunities memo. You should have that in your packet. He'll talk about the opportunities in and around the airport and how important that is and how that ties in with not only on airport but off airport, and particularly about jobs and the quality of jobs and the jobs we're trying to focus on. I know Bill's going to take a minute after I speak to talk about that single issue about jobs and how that interrelates to what we're trying to do in the Economic Development Office. And the third and final is, I think, what's most important and often is overlooked, is how do we finance all this? And we have Brian Martin, who's sitting in the front row. He'll come up and talk if you have questions for. That's really looking at the financial model. Like, how do we pay for this? We threw out 3 plans to you last week. It's great to look at colors on a map and where things fit, but how does that pencil out for the city? How does that relate to the type of jobs and how does that interrelate to the airport? So I want to take a minute and talk about that. And so I'm going to turn that over to Bill, and then we'll go into Mark and Jeff.
Great. Thank you, Scott. Good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of council. I just want to take 2 minutes, and I promise not more than that, to to touch upon the economic impact of the Gateway area. And one of the things that attracted me to Mesa, it was the tremendous upside. And I really think that the potential at the Gateway is a big part of that upside. But the opportunity to plan at this particular location in one of the premier employment centers, really it's very important for us to focus on jobs, and not just any jobs, but high-quality, high-paying jobs. So my challenge is as we try to reposition the city and the opportunities that are in front of us, is really how do I create those destination locations, those high-quality locations that regional headquarters, corporate offices are all looking for. And again, it goes back to the job discussion. They all want to be somewhat located together. Doesn't mean that we're not going to have a variety of employment opportunities, but certainly the focus on the quality of the jobs, the diversity of the high-paying jobs is something that we continue to work with not the developers, but the consultants on as we continue to look at what do we really want it to be in the very near future. So I guess that what I'd like you to think about is, one is the quality of jobs can also affect financing. It can also affect the ability to attract other interested tenants, and by that, or other interested users. So what I guess to conclude real quickly here is, as we go forward, I really want you to focus on and keep in mind the importance of the high-quality jobs it is as it relates to what we're trying to lay out. Really, it's something that we struggle with as we have no trouble attracting some retail, but how do we attract the diverse types of uses that we all need? So that's my general statement, and turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning. I'd like to take a few minutes to give you an update on our work as we've been preparing for the workshop that begins later this morning out at the ASU Polytech Ballroom. We're going to be there the remainder of the day today, as well as a good portion of the day tomorrow, to discuss with a number of stakeholders, the general public and those of you who are interested, the various plans that we have in development, opportunity for you to sit and talk with some of our experts on issues that may be of specific interest to you as a part of this. But by way of introduction to that subject today, I'd like to again just give you a brief overview of some of the findings that we've made in the evaluation that we've been doing as a part of these three alternatives or concepts that we've been developing for this process. As we've talked before, we do have a vision statement that we had identified through our visioning process for this study, but I think most importantly, we come back to the goal or the challenge that was presented to us by you, the council, when we initiated this process, that you really wanted us to find a way to develop a plan that really got to the point of developing at least 100,000, or the opportunity for 100,000 high-quality, high-wage jobs by 2030 within this area, while still protecting the airport operations that, as Scott mentioned, are critical to the continued success of the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. We have three land use concepts that we've been working with. We had talked about in a little bit more detail during our last presentation. The first concept is one that really has more of a mixed-use focus and has the highest proportion of housing to jobs. We have a second concept that's more market-based and kind of a conventional development pattern that might occur in that area. And then the third concept is the one that really maximizes the issue of airport protection, and as well as the industrial uses in terms of creating those sorts of jobs around the airport and its immediate environs. We have made a couple of changes in these concepts based on your input as a part of our last briefing. Most importantly, the elimination of some of the residential that we had shown in close proximity to the airport on the south or southwest side of the Williams Freeway, the Gateway Freeway through that area. I think that as we go through this analysis, it's important to recognize that as we've been making these changes, some of these nuances are not reflected in our analysis, but they are kind of a balancing or shifting of where we've had different land use opportunities, and so the overall information that we're presenting to you is still pretty accurate in terms of how these are evaluated against each other. This is our concept B, and again, as a reminder from our discussion last time, the areas that are crosshatched in each of these plans are the areas
through our estimations of absorption and build-out of the plans are the areas that are likely not to be fully developed by 2030, and those in the solid colors are those for which we believe we can achieve build-out or development of those areas in that timeline. And then
Well, you're going through these slides pretty quickly. You've added some contours on here that weren't here before over the airport. Were those contours there before?
I believe that they were. That these maps are refined over what we had seen before, so they might not have been as visible, but the contours that are there are the 65 DNLs from the airport, from the currently adopted Part 150 study for the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport.
But you didn't map out the fly-friendly procedure and where the planes normally fly, right?
We'll get to that.
Okay. Go ahead.
And then Concept C is the concept, as I mentioned earlier, that really focuses on more of the industrial uses around the airport as consistent with, in that area, what is currently in the city's general plan. We have done forecasts on the build-out of these areas, as I mentioned, to look at build-up of both population and jobs within the area. It's a graphic showing the distribution of the land uses in terms of acreages that would build out by 2030. And as you can see, Scenario A is really the most aggressive in terms of what could be accomplished, has a much higher proportion of land developed for residential purposes. By contrast, we have Scenario C, which is heavier on the industrial side, and obviously that affects or has implications to the opportunities for residential and some of the other uses within that area. Scenario B is the only one of these, and we'll show you here in a little different distribution that really provides more in terms of jobs than it does in terms of residential population growth within that area. So we have by 2030 forecasts for both population and employment for each of these three scenarios that will feed into and have fed into the financial modeling as well as the transportation modeling that has been done as a part of this process. As I mentioned, we do have jobs forecasts and housing that show significant difference between just the amount of that's accomplished within each of these for the three alternatives, with A providing the greatest opportunity for employment growth and jobs within that area. Also important to that discussion, as Mr. Jabginiak was mentioning, was the emphasis on high-quality, high-wage jobs. And Concept A is the concept that provides the greatest proportion of office employment within this area, and it was one of the focuses that we had in helping us achieve that goal of hitting the 100,000 by 2030. Concept B, by contrast, is lower in employment overall, and Concept C is fairly comparable in terms of industrial-type jobs that would be created within the area, but significantly less in terms of the office opportunities that would be realized as well. As we've gone through this discussion, it is also important for us to recognize, as we looked at this mix of land uses, the changing demographics in terms of home ownership and the interest that people have in terms of their home buying choices, and the increasing preference as identified by the National Association of Realtors for people who are looking for higher density mixed-use communities that give them better proximity to job opportunities and the other things that they do throughout their day. And reflecting in that is that Concept A provides us with the most in terms of mixed use and attached housing. While it has the most housing units overall, it also has a greater diversity of the housing types that would be provided within the study area. We have completed an initial analysis of each of these three alternatives to look at what the transportation impacts are as it relates to travel demands and growth within the area. We started with a travel network that basically reflects what's currently in the life cycle program and the Williams Gateway Freeway for this area, with a couple of upgrades that went into this analysis, and used a lot of the background information, as we had discussed before, from Maricopa Association of Governments in terms of the forecasts of traffic coming from areas like Superstition Vistas, Queen Creek, Gold Canyon, and other areas that would be affecting the study area in terms of background traffic. Very quickly, the three concepts, you're familiar obviously with a lot of the analysis you've seen regionally before that kind of identifies the red, yellow, and green in terms of where the problem areas are. In looking at the networks in terms of a very basic roadway infrastructure with four lanes on most of these facilities as a starting point for that analysis,
These maps identify the areas where we recognize that in the refinement of these plans, we're going to have to look at possibility early on of six lanes for build out or other improvements to the system to get the red out of the maps and make them function more efficiently. So we have Concept A, which because of its greater land use and intensity has a higher level of congestion on some of the arterials that are within that area. We have Concept B, which has some congestion in it as well, but again is one that has the least amount of development in terms of what occurs by 2030 within the area. And we have Concept C, which has a comparable level of congestion on a couple of the arterials to be addressed, but again is the one that's kind of in the middle between the two in terms of overall development and opportunities in that time frame. So mentioned Concept A is the one that has the highest level of trip generation, but also significant in that it also has the highest number of trips that are captured internally. So those are people who in their travel during the day are able to do the things they need to do between home and work and other opportunities without leaving the study area, and that's reflected in the capture that we have of trips internally to that study area. Obviously, in terms of the vehicle miles traveled, the plans are fairly comparable. Even though Concept A has more trips, the trips tend to be slightly shorter in length.
I have a question on that. You're talking about the internal capture, how many of the folks that are living there are also driving within that. How much of that, does that also include importation? That is, people who are living outside the study area but are driving into it? And if not, what is, which one of these models provides the highest number of cars coming into this area from others?
Mayor, Council, the plans as they are defined in terms of the characteristics of trips that have been evaluated, we have internal, external trips that were evaluated as a part of this model as well. So those would be the trips that are being generated elsewhere and coming into the area, attracted into the area, as well as those trips that are generated within this area for those who may drive outside of the study area to go to work. So in the overall evaluation of the performance of the system, those trips are accounted for. The internal trip capture is simply those trips that begin and end within the study area. They are trips that once you've gotten in your car to drive to work in the morning, you're not leaving the study area.
I'm most interested in that particular statistic, but also I'm interested in the statistic that shows how many people from outside the study area will be anticipated to drive into the study area, because we're looking at making this a job center, a high-quality job center, so that's an important statistic when we're considering that. Mm-hmm. I have to apologize. My eyesight's fairly decent, but there's quite a bit of glare and tiny little letters. So could you describe to me what the yellow, the orange, and hi, Tom, the yellow, the orange, and the red are indicating on this graph here?
Yes, the yellow coloring at the bottom of the bar represents the pass-through trips. Those are trips that are being generated elsewhere for folks who are going to drive through this area for work, for shopping, for other things. It's basically the traffic that comes out of the regional travel model that's been generated by other studies and looked at the traffic that is passing through the study area.
And it's a combination of people driving through to get to work somewhere else, or driving in, stopping, grabbing a Starbucks,
correct,
and then moving on?
Correct.
Well, they got to shop in Mesa.
That's right.
Okay.
Agreed.
Okay.
And that is traffic, again, that is basically the background that begins the baseline of this discussion on which we build our other numbers in terms of traffic demand.
Why doesn't that match closer with your job housing ratio in that area, though?
The yellow.
Is this in 2030?
Yes, the yellow bars are constant at the bottom, because that is background information that came from other studies and from the MAG model. So that's a constant number to the three alternatives.
Please.
Stated another way, is if this area didn't develop, that's your 2030 prediction without this development area?
If the roadways that are currently in the MAG plan are built and no other development occurs within this area, that is the traffic that will be using those roadways and passing through the study area.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Mark explained there is a relationship between the reason that the
internal trips are higher depending on the type of development. Because that's related to the number of jobs that are being created there, right?
Correct. The red color, which represents the internal trips, we have a greater number of those internal trips that are staying within the study area. In addition, in the analysis that we are using from the Institute of Transportation Engineers and others to look at trip generation rates, mixed-use development, and particularly higher density mixed-use development, as reflected in some of the mixed-use centers within Concept A, is a type of development that tends to generate fewer trips by the type of land use because of the greater opportunity for people to walk and use other modes to make shorter trips throughout the day. So in the model, there's a balance between the form and the content of the development, the amount that occurs, and the estimation of what types of trips those uses are going to generate. So while Concept A generates significantly more development in terms of population and jobs, it does not necessarily generate, as shown in the bar charts, a commensurate level of trips overall in terms of traffic generation. Okay. As I mentioned, we have Mr. Brian Martin from Fishkind Associates who's with us this morning. I'm going to briefly touch on the financial impact model that he has developed for this study area. And this is one of the subjects which I'm sure we will have more discussion on in the future as these numbers get refined. The financial impact model is one that estimates the costs and revenues associated with land use decisions and with the development opportunities that we're looking at within this study area. It's an innovative tool that has been researched by an Urban Land Institute peer review committee and endorsed by the ULI for use on large-scale planning efforts such as this one, and really takes a lot of input from local characteristics in terms of the financial tools and resources that you have within the city of Mesa today as well as available to us throughout the region, looks at the demographic trends in terms of the things that we've proposed in terms of development opportunities, as well as some of the other changes in demographics that may be affecting the development patterns, and then looks at all of the operating and capital costs associated with not only the construction and provision of services, but the administration and financing of those services over time as well. In brief summary, when we take a look at these three alternatives, we have three bar charts here that summarize in the red, orange, and yellow, starting from the left with the yellow, the operating costs. These are the net costs, so there's a operating expense and there's an operating cost recovery for certain services within the city. This looks at the total amount of operating expenditure, the net expenditure that would be required by the city between now and 2030 to build out Concept A, for example. The orange bar shows, in case of each of these, the deficit that would occur on the capital side. So when we look at the current resources that are available for offsetting capital construction and we look at the estimation of the cost necessary to provide the infrastructure for the development of this area, when we look at the arterial streets, when we look at the other public services and things that would be required or have physical needs within the area, you'll see that Concept A has the more significant deficit in terms of that capital. B is the least and C is somewhere in between. The red bar shows then when we balance those two what the net fiscal impact is in terms of the opportunity to be realized with the development of this area in these patterns. And as you can see, as currently defined and analyzed, Concept B is the one that has the total net, the greatest net impact in terms of the financial opportunities with the development of the study area. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Kleimans to talk briefly about the airport.
Yes, thank you, Mark. The perspectives that I bring to this exercise involve work in six continents and throughout the Caribbean, looking at airports that have grown and developed in tandem with their communities and those that have grown at a different pace, perhaps lagging behind, in some cases leading development around them. And one of the most important features of airport development that is in front of you as council and as senior staff in dealing with the recommendations that our study team will be bringing forward is the fact that airports and Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport is in fact on the cusp of a very dramatic change. The airport as you knew it is not the airport that it will become and become in a very short period of time. And that is not simply driven by decisions taken here. That is a market phenomenon. The growth of the Phoenix metropolitan area generally, the East Valley in particular, are giving rise to very significant market pressures, growth and demand for lands that are both on airport and adjacent to an airport. And Phoenix Mesa, Gateway Airport, offers the opportunity to capture on a relatively clean slate all of the opportunities that are building up and the pressure that's growing in this market for that type of development. And one of the most important things that we have observed in terms of not only where this airport is today, but the near-term and long-term growth potential, is the fact that it is not simply a reason or a means to get into this community. In other words, it's not simply an airport that is a basis, a gateway in the sense of people arriving, but it is also a destination, and it is emerging increasingly as an airport that will provide a catalyst for development in this community. So the numbers that Mark cited previously that are the basis for the population and employment projections that we're working with recognize the growth of this airport over time. The fact that we did not simply hold the airport constant, that somehow it was static and all this development was taking place around it, the airport is in fact an engine for that growth. The question is, what type of an engine will it be? Will it give rise to the type of white-collar, high-tech, innovative, or high-quality jobs that we've been talking about, or could it give rise to other types of employment that may be desirable to have in this community, but perhaps would spin off less downstream opportunities in terms of commercial and high-tech growth and development. And so the steps that we've been considering in order to reconcile the challenge, in other words, how to take advantage of the growth within the airport fence, and it's important to remember that Phoenix Mesa Airport has a footprint that is almost identical to that of Sky Harbor. They're both around 3,000 acres, plus or minus. So what you're looking at here as an opportunity for airport growth within the fence is quite significant and rivals in many ways Sky Harbor. What is interesting, however, and the greater challenge you have is how do you use that opportunity outside the airport fence? How do you recognize that there is, in fact, as we suggest here, an aviation envelope? Airport planning is, interestingly enough, one of the most interesting types of planning because it's done in three dimensions. You plan on the ground and you plan in the airspace above the airport, but you also have to plan and account for the land uses surrounding the airport that will be impacted not by what takes place at the airport proper, but the effects of that development in terms of aircraft movements, aircraft noise, and how do you reconcile those opportunities and potential conflicts. In terms of the planning process that we have embarked upon as a study team, and our contribution to it in particular, recognizes those two challenges, that you have noise created by an airport, you also have land use effects that extend beyond the boundary, and we've just cited here two federal regulations, what are referred to as Part 150 and Part 77, dealing with noise and height restrictions respectively. These are factors that can be taken into account, and in fact are being taken into account, not simply as impediments to development, but rather as opportunities to development, because when we understand where these boundaries lie in the future, given the type of aircraft activity that will occur at this airport, as it becomes a prominent regional aviation center, we're able to account for the kind of land uses that can coexist within these particular constraints. And to illustrate the point, The area that's highlighted in red represents a footprint on the ground of noise contours that are evident through the operations in the air. This is, I believe, Mark, if I'm correct, a 2005 or 2006 contour. The 65 DNL refers to the day-night noise boundary. It's a rather complex term of art, but in essence, it refers to the area within which certain types of residential, commercial, and industrial development may be more susceptible to adverse impact than areas that lie outside that red envelope or boundary. The key point that we want to stress is that that envelope, that red area, is an area in transition. It will change over time as the airport becomes a more significant passenger conduit into this region, not simply to Mesa, but to the entire East Valley. The changes, however, are likely to be very modest. And so what is important to recognize is when we overlay that red contour, both as it exists today and as it will exist in the future, it does not represent a significant deterrent to any form of land use development throughout a significant portion of the study area. It's an area to be recognized, it's an area to be protected, but it does not quarantine development, including residential development, throughout significant portions of the study area.
Scott? I have another question on, this map. First of all, was this based on existing flight patterns? How did you develop this map? Because just looking at it doesn't seem to represent the flight path that aircraft take, particularly off the north side. I suppose we should just say the north side, because the planes have to make a sharp right. So where's that map?
Mayor, Council Summers, this is a map from the airport authority, the airport themselves. This is their latest Part 150 or DNL study.
How'd they come up with this one?
They have consultants that spend, and it takes months for them to do, I don't know the technology that they use to measure the decibel levels, but this is from the airport today. This is the most current 65 DNL contour that's out there. That shoulder you see on the right represents the right turn. And then the yellow represents 60. I think that's the 60 DNL.
Correct.
So this is the latest.
Latest, greatest map.
That's been handed out, that's currently on file with the airport today. You know, at some point in the future, like every airport, they'll continue to update these over time. But right now, this is the latest one that I received on Tuesday morning.
Let me follow up with a question. So if I went to off your map a little bit to the northeast, which is the fly-friendly departure corridor, this map does not say that there wouldn't be an occurrence of greater than 65 decibels in my backyard if I'm outside barbecuing. This is an average of day-night average readings of noise contours. It's not a single event noise contour.
That is correct.
And I think that's what Scott was talking about. We can show where different planes fly. And if you got a cargo plane at 2 in the morning that's very noisy, people aren't going to care whether your contour says it shouldn't be there. I mean, you average it and it's not there. But that noise event could be significant enough that it would be disruptive to a residential area. So on average, you're comfortable. But when you get somebody rakes you up in the morning at 1 and 5, you're not comfortable. But you're still average, you're okay. That's what that says.
Yeah, Mayor, we're just building the model here. This is the first level where FAA says you have to restrict.
Right.
The single event is another issue that we can show you, depending on the type of aircraft and the flight path they take, that could extend clear to the 60 based on the type of aircraft, on a single event noise. Absolutely. We're going to get there. We're just kind of building on the layers here. We're just starting with the most basic element of what airports look at as they look at the impact of their operations on land use.
Okay.
And I think Scott was referring to a blue line where it shows actual flight paths that are created. It's a radar tracking over a certain period of time, which is interesting.
Yeah, I was just, in my mind, Mayor, I'm picturing that particular one in my head with all the flights that turn off to the right, mm-hmm. as they depart heading north. And this, the 60 and 65 just seem to be straight out. I mean, it's heading right into Gilbert, and there doesn't seem to, there's no turn on this particular piece. I would have thought there would have been more of a curve on that north side, given the flight path of the aircraft.
Mayor and Council Summers, as I recall, this represents both arrivals and departures. So why, one of the reasons you may have the on the north, east, and that configuration is more likely related to arrivals coming in on that end. And then the shoulder to the right represents the departures. And remember, at some point, the planes get to an elevation, an altitude, where the doesn't register on the 65 DNL, and it doesn't register on the 60 DNL. Now, as more activity continues to occur at the airport with more intensity and different planes, that study, as required by FAA, will continue to be updated, and you may see a little bit more of that configuration. But I think we have a slide later that's going to actually show you what Sky Harbor looks like, so you can kind of see that, kind of how that looks too.
And there is the slide for Sky Harbor. If I can offer you some perspective, because unfortunately I don't have a pointer, and I'm sure these lines blur on the screen. There is, looking from left to right on this screen, you'll notice there is what would appear to be an arrow shape pointing toward the airport. The two prongs on either side and a V in the middle. Yes, that's right. That represents the 65 DNL contour on the western limit of Sky Harbor. And if you were to follow that contour both north and south of the airport, you'll notice that it follows relatively close to the water course, and then on the eastern side of the airport actually cuts through existing and planned development areas within Tempe. So it is important to note that 65 DNL is not a hard barrier to development. It is not a boundary to development. It is not an imposition to development. It simply means for planning purposes that development on the ground must be sensitive to the noise that is generated by that airport. And there are noise mitigation measures, a number of measures, including acoustic treatment of housing, measures that involve the identification on title to property, that people purchasing property are living with an area subject to certain levels of aircraft noise. So there are steps that can be taken to permit a wide range of development to occur within that high noise impact area, but it is not a firm or rigid barrier to development.
On the other hand, I will say as somebody who worked in Phoenix, that Phoenix has spent quite a bit of money to acquire residential properties inside that 65 DNL over on the west side. And I know that because working for the fire department, when they bought them, they still stayed there. We had a lot of fires. So I had some fun. But they purchased a lot of those. They're turning that into commercial properties. And the residential side on the Tempe border, there's still a lot of tension between Tempe and Phoenix surrounding this airport. So hence our bit of reservation on making certain that the 65 and even the 60 are well identified and properly identified in the map, so that when DMB and some of the other owners come forward with their development plans, that they know exactly where to put the residential versus the commercial industrial base, which is what they're trying to do.
Well, that's an excellent point. If I may just respond briefly, it's my understanding that neither scenarios A, B, or C contemplate any residential development, even within the 60 contour, within the study area.
That's great. Vice Mayor.
Let me just follow up on that for a moment, because one of the issues that has caused Tempe to want Gateway to develop is the overflights of planes, and they don't want another, an additional fourth runway to be built at Sky Harbor. They're very concerned about that. So obviously there are some areas, now the areas where you're talking about in terms of construction that's going on, that's new construction that's going on in Tempe, with the knowledge that the airport exists, with those attenuation measures in place that you talked about. But there are areas outside of that right now that Tempe has been complaining about to Phoenix for years. In what category are those? Do you happen to know what category of sound those areas are?
Vice Mayor and Council, the areas in Tempe that you're referring to in terms of some of the previous controversy that has existed on the subject of the noise contours, a lot of that existing development that was affected by the growth of Sky Harbor and the expansion early on of that 65 DNL was in fact low-density, single-family, for the most part residential, that was not built to a standard of addressing, and again without the recognition that they are going to be within that noise impact area. So a lot of the acquisitions and the things that have occurred, as Councilman Summers were referring to, were mitigation measures taken to address those people who lived in an area which was later encumbered by that 65 DNL. And it was a measure taken by the airport, as it has been at many airports, to provide mitigation to the satisfaction of the Federal Aviation Administration for those locations. So the difference is, you're right, there is new construction that is occurring in Tempe. It is typically higher density construction that is built to a different standard, and with the recognition by the buyers and the developers that it is close proximity to that 65 DNL.
Okay, thank you.
How much of the noise contours going to the east is that they're narrow is because of the 3-mile DME gate provision that Tempe cut with Phoenix with the third runway's construction? Are you familiar with that issue too?
I'm not familiar with the details of how that pattern was narrowed as a result of that agreement, Mayor.
Yeah, I think that has a significant impact on this one, because it funneled everything down, and then the 101, 202 is where they branch off, and then they cut over the top of Mesa. So it did channel it all through the river. And it's a 3-mile long corridor and a quarter mile visual gate that they have to arrive and depart from. And I think that has a huge bearing on your noise contour example here. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to establish the same thing at Gateway, but maybe we should look at it.
Understood. And if I could, to kind of take you to where we're headed in this process and the work that we're doing, obviously the fundamental issue here with the airport is really from a land use perspective, not only the airport operations, but also that importantly relies on what type of air service is going to be predominant within the airport itself, because that has a very significant impact on the types of businesses and jobs to be created within that area. Passenger service by nature tends to be one that occurs during times of the day when people have a greater tolerance for noise, and it also is the activity that does more to attract the Class A office space, hospitality, entertainment, the types of things that lend themselves to the high-wage, high-paying, high-quality jobs that Mr. Jabjiniak was referring to earlier. Cargo service, by contrast, tends to happen 24/7, tends to be heavier aircraft, as well as requiring a lot of activity specifically in heavy trucking for distribution that is not necessarily conducive or is appealing to Class A office and residential in close proximity as some of the activities that occur with an airport that has a heavier passenger service emphasis. So that's obviously a significant part of this consideration, because it's the nature of those operations that then feeds into the definition of not only what the noise contours are for the airport, because obviously the more activity that we have that occurs outside the hours of the business day into the sensitive hours that you're referring to in the middle of the night, Mayor, that significantly affects the definition of that DNL. It also helps us understand better what the flight patterns are and the area that needs to be protected as a part of this process. So concurrent with our process of continuing to look at the land use opportunities, specifically now as it relates to their impacts on transportation, the costs, and how we finance the various pieces of the infrastructure that are necessary to be doing that. We are also working with your staff to convene a group to focus on specifically identifying the issue of what the future flight protection overlay should look like for this area, taking into account not only the noise that may occur today within that defined 65 DNL, but also the forecast as to what those areas could look like in the future based on the nature and the type of flights that are apt to be predominant within the airport and future modeling for those noise contours. Again, that process in bringing together an understanding of an aviation envelope to be protected for the Mesa Gateway area, along with the land use opportunities that we have, we need to work together in bringing those two pieces together so that we can again work towards achieving the goal of the 100,000 high-quality, high-wage jobs for this area in the future.
Mark, could you go back to scenario A real quickly? I want to make something really clear. Okay, there we go. If council, the reason I wanted to show this was if you can see, maybe Scott can point to the contours again of the 65 DNL. And the point is, this is the highest density development proposal. This is probably the most ultimate, you know, you could get on development. Nothing underneath that 65 or even the 60, as was stated, suggests anything related to residential or compatible. So the point is, we want to work with this, and then we also want to consider flight paths and then where the contours may eventually begin to move as the airport develops with more flights, and determining really the mix of flights, what they may be, whether they're passenger, whether they're cargo, or a combination of the two, and what impact that may have as we look at the future land uses. The other thing we're going to be noting too in working with Sky Harbor is providing information to us, is as they depart out of the airport and make that right turn, what elevation are they at, what altitude are they at different intervals as they continue going east, because most of those flights will go east, and if they end up ultimately they're determined to go westbound, they'll do a large circle and then go on out. So we are going to convene both consultants of the city has under HDR. We've asked the Gateway Airport to make available the consultant they have working on their master plan development, and any other consultants from any stakeholders that are in the area, tenants or in the community that would like to contribute, and get them all together and really talk about, as Mark said, is really what is the necessary arrangements and considerations we need to make, both on the contours of noise as well as flight paths, elevations, and the types of development that may be compatible. Compare that with other airports across the country and see how they're using those, how they manage that activity at the same time. So we want to come back. I'm going to convene that pretty quickly and then come back to council with some discussion on that.
Vice Mayor.
Chris, I think that may be the most critical component of this plan. Without that, I don't know how we move forward on this decision-making process. And you know, you're going to have to bring in those people who are currently based at the airport. I know in the past that they have felt like they've been left out of this discussion, and they have some items that they think haven't been considered that need to be considered, including some of the training academies that are out there,
correct, Mayor, Vice Mayor. What's interesting is as we've been able to get some preliminary information on flight paths, there really is a distinctive flight path for the planes, the fixed wings versus the helicopters. One of the things that we've talked about is really separating that, because there's a different kind of operation. And we have a very large new tenant out there in Allegiant, and one of the things we need to do is outreach to their operations side, because frankly right now they are predominant in the flight paths, and they're the ones that are dictating what's going on out there as far as where the planes go. Beyond that, we've continued, if you can, you'll notice, and we'll get you the larger versions and hard copies of this. We mentioned before, we have gone back and made the adjustments on the proposed alignment of the Gateway Freeway to protect that, buffer that, with the idea that that could be used for experimental heavy load testing of different types of helicopters. So we've accommodated that. We believe that that best fits. And based on history of flight paths, we think that will work well. What our concern now is really working on the passenger side and what mix of cargo, if any, there would be at the airport and how that would impact flight paths and impacts the community underneath.
The departure to the northwest, if you were to fly that, my understanding is, and you flew the noise contour as it's depicted up there, you'd actually have a conflict with Sky Harbor and their arrival and departure. So what they've done at Gateway is they had a fly-friendly procedure, and that's where the power lines are, and you turn to the right. There was a waypoint established out in Pinal County. The technology is not quite there to move all of the airport airplanes to fly two waypoints, but I think that's coming in the next few years as they standardize the equipment. So what I'm hoping that we can look at, not just noise contours, but flight corridors. Where is the corridor that the planes are going to be flying? And how do you protect beneath them? It may not be in the 60 or the 65, but there's going to be a substantial number of planes, and occasionally they're going to be very loud. You get cloud cover or something else, it's going to be a loud event. So I'm more interested in flight corridors than I am FAA required. There's the noise contours. So if I could kind of pass that comment on, I would appreciate if somebody would pay attention to it. And the other one is the flight corridors also go with the helicopters. Now we have a great freeway that's going to go out to Pinal County that might allow McDonnell Douglas and some of our testing facilities to stay around forever. And I would love to look at that flight corridor to make sure that our businesses, some of the helicopter operations in particular, have a way to parallel that freeway and get in and out. So those are the two things that I would like. Hopefully we can incorporate a little bit that thought process into the planning and see if it works. Because this is not the typical airport, but the way that thing departs to the northwest, there's a natural conflict with Sky Harbor. Otherwise, we'd depart to the northwest, we'd hit US 60, and we'd follow it out. And we can't because it's too close to Sky Harbor's flights. So that's the information I'd like to pass on. Scott?
And just to bounce off that a little bit, Mayor, as I look at the map up here, what concerns me about this particular piece is, for the most part, this looks good. I'm not as worried about the number of residential units. I'm more concerned about the job-to-resident ratio. I want a high number of jobs compared to the number of residents, because there are a lot of residential units to the north and to the west of this area, to the south as well, and we can anticipate a good number of rooftops developing in the in Pinal County. So this needs to be, we've been saying this a long time, needs to be the job center, the high quality job center for this. That said, there is room for some residential units. That's probably going to be more density, and I'm okay with that as long as that doesn't interfere with the airport operations. Looking at this map, the one piece that concerns me, and bouncing off what the mayor said, with the flight patterns, is the one yellow residential piece. It would be south of the power lines and as the Loop 202 makes its curve. This is the first time I've ever seen any residential down in that area. Little concern about any residential there, and it goes off of having those aircraft make that right-hand turn. It's going to be flying right over this area. Another issue you had mentioned utilizing, or maybe Mr. Brady mentioned utilizing the freeway, the Williams Gateway Freeway, as that natural corridor for helping with the helicopters coming in and out. What may be a better alignment is just a little bit north of that is Williams Field Road. That would allow a little bit of buffer both to on the north side of the freeway. It was part of the agreement we made with the Levine property, preserve keeping the residential north. But it also, a pet peeve of mine is whenever you abut residential up against a freeway. Freeway should be an economic corridor. That is where you create jobs. That's where you have offices. That's where you have retail. It is not a good place for housing. So by just moving that a little bit north, it's maybe a half mile and using. Is that what it says?
Yeah.
It's, again, I'm looking at where.
You cannot read those maps.
Yeah. Well, it's brown, and I'm assuming brown is some kind of a mixed-use residential component. I'm
We'll get to the map.
I'll have to get the maps, but if we at least put in our thinking, Williamsfield Road is that line. We've created a little bit more buffer. We are staying consistent with the Levine deal, and again, there's proper places for the residential, and it's probably, and the numbers don't, number of people don't worry me as much as the job resident ratio, and density doesn't scare me, so
I agree. That's fine. Okay. Does that conclude your presentation?
One more thing, Mayor. I think you'll get in the next few days, if I'm correct, a financial PowerPoint that'll lay out some, the three different scenarios and what the financial impact will be for the city, just as you see it today. It's not the final version, but it'll give you an idea of how scenario A impacts the city and what the financial cost would be, both capital and operating, as well as B and C. And I think that's important to relate as we talk about jobs in the airport, that those definitely have a ripple effect on financial impacts.
I'll be looking forward to seeing the financial impact. It looked like interesting study work on that, so I'd like to see the supporting data on that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Item number three is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the projects included in the anticipated 2008 bond election, including streetlight projects. Vice Mayor.
Mayor, this came back because at the last council meeting, Councilmember Whalen at the last study session was not able to be here.
He is not here
today because of a family emergency, which he needed to take care of, which was the right thing to do. But let me make a proposal. He talked to me. He called me this morning to let me know he wasn't going to be here, and said he was supportive of the putting some of this in for the public safety bond. He does not want it in the street bond. He wants to make sure that emphasis occurs in the areas that I was talking about, where we have neighborhoods that are really trying to fight crime, they're trying to revitalize, they're trying to do good things in their neighborhood, and they need some street lighting, they need some partnership with the city to try and fight that situation. So, Mayor, I don't know if I can get to four votes with the people who are here today, but I am willing to back off on the number and you know, be consistent with what I've done with other things, which is go with a public safety model on how we allocate those resources, and I'm willing to do that. He offered his support, but without his vote here, support is nice, but you know, one needs a vote.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a dollar magnitude in mind, Vice Mayor?
You know, I'm just shooting at numbers here, but I thought if because of the number of years that we're looking at, if we could look at $6 million, I think we're looking at a six-year time frame, and that would put in about $1 million a year in order to address that. Now, there's nothing magic about that number. I just know, I'm just very familiar with some of these neighborhoods that have been talking to us about could we help them with this, and we don't have, you know, there aren't resources there right now to be able to do that, and so I'm looking for a way to address those public safety things. I do believe generally, in terms of my philosophy, that streetlights should be part of transportation, but really I'm taking a public safety approach on where the use of these funds would take place, and that's why he wants it to be in the public safety bond.
Okay, and I think we had some discussion on increased spacing, and can you remind me what the old standard was, or is it just very vary throughout the whole city versus the current standard. I remember 240 foot versus 180, but I may be making those up here today.
The new standard is roughly in residential areas is 180 to 200 feet on the pole spacing. The older standards varied a bit. We have some neighborhoods where they just have lighting at intersections. We have some neighborhoods where their poles are 300 to 500 feet apart. So it kind of varies throughout the city.
Mayor, if the staff, if you, you could let the staff just quickly go through the present. What we've tried to do is go back to the end of the conversation we had last time was how would you develop a criteria, a kind of prioritization, and we've tried to attempt to do that. We could go real quickly through this if you don't mind.
Okay.
Would that be?
Yes.
Good morning. We did, after our last meeting, we sat down and talked about how could we look at this from more of a technical basis. How could we identify neighborhoods that might be a higher priority than other neighborhoods. We looked at our system. There's about 30,000 streetlights out there. 8,000 of those are direct vary. And what we found is there's really four categories that those neighborhoods fit in right now. There's areas that are fully lit. There are areas of low lighting, which may be the intersection or the wide spacing on the poles. There are areas of no lighting. And there are areas where SRP has lighting systems within our city. So what we did, and Lenny's going to talk a little bit more about it, we did an analysis of those areas using our city's GIS system because Lenny's staff has every pole in the city in that GIS system. And we focused on residential areas, no commercial industrial, no giant parking lots. And what we did was we tried to look at how to get maybe the biggest bang for the buck in terms of overlapping criteria.
Thanks, Beth. The slide you have there kind of shows a quarter section, Dobson, Main Street, University area, Longmore, kind of by the transit facility and light rail. What we did was we took drew a circle or an arc around the street, every one of the street lights, and just took an analysis to see which lights would cross over and touch overlap, and that's how we figured out which section of the lights, which areas we needed to identify. In this example here, if you notice east of Sycamore or to the right of Sycamore, that subdivision there is lacking lighting in the middle. The yellow is the lights, and the white spot is the actual area that's gapped. So we went through and did an analysis that approximately a quarter section will have approximately 150 street lights. And then we just kind of said, well, this is half of this subdivision or half of this quarter section would take about 75 street lights. And that's how we came up with our analysis throughout the process. We did that throughout the whole city.
And so then we broke them into the four categories we talked about earlier. We did look at overlapping criteria where in category A we have looked at neighborhoods with low lighting, plus also areas where we'll be going in to do overlays. In many of our neighborhoods where we have low lighting, there are not continuous conduits and circuits to feed these lights. They're fed individually. So what we'd like to do is focus on those areas where we also may be doing overlays in the streets so we don't cut pavement that we would like to keep a little longer. Plus, we added to that overlaid direct bury poles. B, we looked at low lighting and direct bury. C, we looked at low lighting. And D was no lighting. So we started with a map like this, and you can see it visually. It is a little bit small, but I think we provided larger copies for you. These are just areas of the city that we would be looking at doing overlays that also have low lighting and direct bury poles, which would allow us to get to maybe three programs in the same program. You see it's about 25 quarter sections, I believe, in the map. The next map picks up low lighting and direct bury, and you can kind of see those overhead there together, the two criteria together. Three looks at low lighting, and it overlaps the original A and B categories and puts them all together. So you can see there's just a few out there that have low lighting but don't have direct bury poles. D is no lighting. These are neighborhoods that have no lighting at all right now. And we kind of separated out those neighborhoods because many of them annexed in with no lighting at a time when we did have a lighting standard of some sort in place. And then the final one we have up there is a no lighting slide plus the SRP areas. We do have some areas in the city where they originally built in the county. They went to the county and said, we would like to have streetlights. The county doesn't normally do streetlights, so what they did was they did improvement districts, and they went to SRP, and they had SRP design and install the lights. The county collects an assessment for these areas and then pays SRP to operate the lights. The systems in these areas are old. They don't necessarily meet our current today lining criteria. And there are even, in some cases, I believe, some mercury vapor lamps out there. They are in the process of removing all those, but it isn't. It's got some issues there. So when we looked at... Yes, sir?
For some of these areas, two comments. First of all, the no lighting areas, as I look at these lights, some of these areas don't want lights, where they want the lower lights. We're not shoving any lights down anybody's throat if they don't want it, assuming that this were to pass. And another one is Councilmember Truitt was on the phone last week. Some of these areas, this is exactly what he was talking about.
Right.
These developed in the county to county standards. Now they're coming into the city. And I agree with Councilmember Truitt that some of these areas should be paying the cost. If you developed in the county and then annexed into the city, why is the whole city now paying because you developed in the county? We really ought to be looking at these areas to pay the cost of any lighting upgrades. And I think we need to, and I know maybe that isn't a discussion for right now, but as we go forward with this, that should be on the back of our minds here as far as which areas we would want to actually put bond money into. We should be focusing on areas, in my opinion, focus on areas that were developed to city standard, and now that standard is no longer up to par.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, that's going to be our recommendations as we get further down through the presentation. We talked about that's one of our lower-end areas. We need to do some more analysis on the SRP side of it.
So if I wait for your analysis, I don't sound as smart.
Okay. Appreciate that.
Yeah, we understand.
Why don't we quick get to your analysis?
Yeah. Okay. Here we are. We're at the low lighting summary. You can see category A, which kind of gets us all of the programs together in one. We have about 2,200 new poles, a cost of $14.3 million. And then you can go down the list and look at the other categories and how it adds up. We do have the no lighting at the bottom. And then what we'd like to suggest is that we work on category A, and that we work with those neighborhoods and mayor and council to identify a process and a procedure for going forward to light those. Some of those neighborhoods may not want lights, so that would be a discussion we'd have with neighborhoods as we took the program forward.
Okay. The vice mayor has floated the suggestion of $6 million going into the bonds under public safety for street lighting. Discussion? Vice mayor.
And let me stipulate that you know, what I just said is a little bit in conflict with what you said, because my priority here is we have neighborhoods that are working together, that are working with the city. They might be working with our action team. They might just be working with their council member, and they're working to because they have had, you know, potential criminal activity going on in their area. And one of the things that's been identified is that the street lights are substandard in that area. They're putting lights around their homes. They're doing things. But I'm looking for a way for us to partner with them as they are working to fight crime. And, you know, we're looking at a six-year window of time here. And so I'm trying, you know, that's my top priority. And so, you know, we get in a little bit of conflict there. When I look at some of these lines, I'm thinking, well, that leaves out that neighborhood that's working very hard right now to try and address some criminal activity that's going on in their area. And they've come together and they're saying, we don't want to move someplace else. We like our neighborhood. We're trying to take our neighborhood back. And this criteria does not address that. And so that's a concern for me, Mayor.
Okay. All right. Scott?
Vice Mayor, I appreciate that sentiment, and I agree that there are some secondary effects to having street lighting. Some of that reduced accidents and public safety and the lighting deters crime, and I would agree with that. But when we're working with neighborhoods and trying to clean up neighborhoods or help neighbors help themselves, it's not just one entity we don't go to. We just don't go to the police department and say we want to clean this neighborhood up. It is an effort of code enforcement, of the streets department if it involves lighting or traffic signals, of fire and solid waste. A lot of different entities are involved. My concern about this, first of all, I support the idea of the lights, but I just feel that since lighting is paid for out of the streets budget, it should be in a streets bond. And I'm also concerned that we haven't heard anything from public safety about what they feel about having lights in there, in that bond package. I'm not asking any of them to come up today because I don't know that they've actually seen this. So to have them drug up before this tribunal and forced to answer questions, I think is a little early. I'd prefer to hear some feedback from them if I was going to change my mind. But I would I support the lights, but I want it to be in the street package.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Mayor, I don't care which package they're in. That hasn't been my issue. My issue is the method that's used for calculation for where the streets go. So I have one council member who's saying to me he wants to support it if it's in the public safety area. I have another council member who's saying he only wants to support it if it's in the transportation area. But I think that we're working towards the same goal in terms of the criteria. So my issue is not, you know, which bond category it goes into. I can make the argument that you just made, Scott. I think it's a fine argument. We bring everybody together in the city to address issues. I think it's a great argument. I'm trying to get to four votes.
I'm sorry. I guess I'm misunderstanding what you're asking for. I had assumed you were asking for this to go into the public safety bond.
Because that's what Mr. Whalen wants.
He doesn't want it in the street bond?
Well, he's not here to participate.
Oh, okay.
I think that his goal is similar to the goal that I have, which is he's trying to address the public safety issues. He's dealing with the same issues with some of his neighborhoods where, you know, they're trying to work together with public safety. And you're right, they bring in all of these teams. And so I think his focus is, you know, that public safety focus. But that's why I think he wants it in the public safety bond, but I think for the same reasons that I'm talking about. But I don't care which bond it goes in. I just want the criteria for the decision making to be a public safety criteria as one of the top criteria for it.
Tom,
I'm not sure whether to quote Shakespeare about a rose by any other name still smells as sweet, or somebody else about shooting yourself in the foot, but. We have two things going on here. Only one of them is urgent. Only one of them really needs to be addressed today. And I think it actually probably is going to need to be addressed on Monday. And that is, do we include money for streetlights, whether it's $12 million, whether it's $6 million, whether it's $2.35 million. I don't really care what package it goes in. I think there's at least last time there was a 3-3 split on that, and I still don't want to add additional spending to this package. I think this is a package that we spent a lot of time participating in, got a lot of input on. I don't want to make it any bigger. I don't want to risk failure because it gets bigger. The criteria, I think, is something that comes up down the road. It isn't something that we have to decide today or by Monday in order to get this election called. So my sense is, unless Daryl or Keno have changed their mind, we need Mike here. We just put this on the agenda for Monday night and vote on whether or not we include, whether it's $6 million. And if we want to fight over the package, fine. We know where it goes. But I think we need to just find out whether there's four votes today very quick. And if there isn't, put it on the agenda for Monday. It can be on the study session for 5 minutes before the council meeting if we need it, if we even need to do that. Otherwise, it could just be, it's already on the agenda for Monday night.
Right.
But if we want to have more discussion, we can have a 5-minute discussion here.
I want to keep the bond package as simple as possible. I think what we've brought forward was sufficient with the public safety features and the transportation. This is kind of like a later add-on. Had we discussed it as part of public safety originally, maybe, but at this point I'm not interested in adding it to the proposal, so that's mine. Daryl?
I guess a couple of comments. One is that just in your analysis, the thing that I would be the most concerned about is we have this direct Berry component in there, and to me that should not be part of a bonding program. That's a maintenance issue, replacing poles that are rusting out and whatever. That should be maintenance. That ought to be out of HURT, just like maintaining the street pavement and all that sort of stuff. And we're coupling in here. There's a need, but I don't think it's the same need as providing lighting or public safety or whatever. This is maintenance. And so I think we should be pulling this direct Berry stuff out and putting it back in the HERF budget. It's a maintenance issue. The second is I'm kind of with you. You know, you can have things that are good to do and better to do and best to do, and I think we could always find more good things to do to add into a bond program, and better things to do, and then best things to do. And I think that with government we should focus maybe on the best things and the good and the better. I just don't think we have enough money, and the taxpayers have enough money to do everything that we want to do. Now, having said that, I'm not quite done, because I'm seeing Vice Mayor ready to jump on me here. And then the last thing I did is want to say is we talk about whether these people developed in the county or whether they developed in the city. I don't think that's the principle. The principle is whether or not they paid for it. And what if they developed in the city 30 years ago and they never paid for more than a street light on every intersection, why are they any different than someone that developed in the county? You know, you say, well, they developed the city standards. Well, there may have probably weren't any standards hardly back then 30 years ago or 40 years ago or something. So I'm also getting into that idea of encouraging, if we put money in here, of encouraging it, and this gets more into the criteria area, to say, if you want something, are you guys willing to partner with the city? Are you willing to form an ID and pay 50% of the cost or something like that? Those are the things that are more important to me. Going out here and solving, we've got a lot of existing problems out there in the city, and trying to solve them and solve them in a bond package are things I'm a bit concerned about.
Okay, I think we're 3-3. We'll wait for Mr. Whalen to return, as was suggested. Kyle, you can confirm that?
Yeah, we're 3-3. Obviously, we need to wait for Mike. What was just said by Darrell was, I agree, it is a maintenance issue on the rusting poles. However, we don't have the money for it. And it is going to become a very safety factor. Yeah, if we could put it in a maintenance issue, I'd be all for it. But
we have maintenance money. It's a matter of choosing what you spend that maintenance money on.
Yeah. Well, we have enough maintenance issues on streets and stuff that the deterioration is reaching a point that there is no money. And so the bond package is to have a secondary property tax to pay for things that need to be addressed that we are seriously going to need. And if we don't do it now, the next round they'll have to do it, and it'll just be a higher dollar amount.
Yeah. I still see we're at 3-3. Scott?
I just had to make a brief
change
comment. No, no, sir, I'm not, as a matter of fact. But this is framed wrong. This is not a maintenance issue. This is a capital issue. This is not fixing the light, it's replacing the light.
Okay.
Put it more simply, if we're bringing our car in to have some maintenance done on it, you pay for that one way. But when you buy a whole new car, you're going to have to borrow the money. It's not a HERF issue anymore. It's going to need attention. And when these lights start to fall over and create problems, we're going to get the question, where was the good government? And that's why.
No matter what the issue is, whether it's maintenance or what, it's how much do you put in the bond election, as Tom explained. And do you or don't you? We can have debates philosophically if it's, but I think you're also going to have to figure out whether it's in the streets or public safety, because you're going to have to list it in one or the other. So between you and Mike, if you're going to go this direction, you better figure out which way you're wanting to do it.
Okay. Well, not four of us, we won't.
No.
I absolutely agree with you, Mayor. We're going to have to move forward to Monday, but I just have to comment on the good, better, best, because to me, one of the best things that we do is work with neighborhoods on public safety. And so I don't view this as a good or better. I view this as a best, and so I just need to put that on the record.
Okay. All right. Put it back on for Monday's study session.
Yes, Mayor. I think we'll add it as a study session item, because the item as it's posted on the agenda creates, as we talk about in this totality, may create some problems for Councilman Truitt. So we will list it as a separate item in a study session before the council meeting.
And the council meeting, did it have a dollar magnitude? Do you have to lift any dollars at this point, or can we modify it for that night's meeting?
Oh,
I'm sorry, Mayor. Can we
the total bond package that we're recommending? Do we need a dollar cap or a dollar recommendation from this council, or do we just call the election at this point?
it needs to be identified. Does it need to absolutely, you can amend it later on. Monday night, we're looking for a dollar amount, but that can be amended up until the statutory deadline for calling the election.
Okay. But so dollar amount is what we're after. Can they then fight over whether it goes into streets and public safety at a later date?
No, because we're looking for a dollar package for
each
calling each one.
Yes.
All right. And can you work the agenda to allow it to be added if the study session?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Amend it
because
later.
It's a resolution. So, yes, right. We can amend it Monday.
Okay. All right. Let's then move on to item number four, which is discuss and provide direction to pursue a memorandum of agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to participate in 287G cross-training program for the Mesa holding facility. I think you have in your packet a draft letter that's on P4 that I am suggesting that we have a discussion on this morning and potentially mail that out asking the questions that are outlined. But I did want to see if there was council concurrence. I did a similar letter back in September 28, in October 5th of 2006, in which we were informed that they did have a 287G program. I brought that forward to the council, and at that time we voted 5-2 to not move forward. Now we're back, and I know the chief has come forward and indicated that at least in the detention facility it might be worthwhile. So why don't you fill us in on what your current thinking is on making a request for detention in the detention facility to have 287G be able to ask immigration-related issues.
Yes, Mr. Mayor and council members. If you recall, we did a combined presentation here earlier in the year with ICE. And during that presentation, we stated that it would be a desirable thing for us to have 287G trained detention officers or holding facilities. And the reason why we indicated so is because we believe that it will be an added tool for us to deal with people that are being booked and processed through our facility. That was a discussion that I also had personally with the head of ICE locally here prior to that meeting, and it's something that we have been exploring for some time. I am accustomed to working with ICE, and prior to that, quite frankly, with INS, through detention facilities for many, many years. It's worked well in LA, and I think it would work well for us. What we were informed during that meeting here, if you recall, is that the ICE was not funded for this fiscal year to provide any additional 287G training nationwide. I have talked to Mr. Pena again and confirmed that, at least to his knowledge, as it is today, ICE has not been funded to provide any additional training. There are approximately 17,000 law enforcement agencies in the country. There are 80 that have requested this type of training nationwide, and again, Congress did not provide enough funding for that process for this fiscal year. But we're certainly in support if there is a way to get the money to do it. Detention 287G training for detention officers is a 5-week training, and what it gives them the opportunity is that when people are brought into the detention facility, they develop the expertise necessary, plus they're sort of deputized in order to follow a line of questioning that would be with the intention of assessing the immigration status of anyone that goes through the facility that is not a U.S.-born person.
Okay. I've outlined a series of questions that I had, and it seems like the first three you've answered, that there is not a program currently being funded.
Correct.
But question number four is, if funding is not currently available, can the city of Mesa pay for the training? And you indicated that's a 5-week training. Are they even offering the training program if we would agree to pay for the training ourselves? And then I guess we still need an answer to question number two. What is the per officer cost of the training? And then your analysis on whether there would be a payback on our reduced jailing costs if we did have those officers in place.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that this will not be a cost-saving enterprise for the city of Mesa. The more that we embark in any kind of immigration enforcement, whether we do it at the detention facility or the streets, you're going to add operational costs to the city. The model as is currently it has currently been done by the federal government is that the federal government has funded the entire training process. I believe that they train somewhere between 25 and 30 individuals to a class. I am not aware of any instances at this point where a municipality or a county or a state has actually paid for the training. I do not know what the cost per capita is because it will be clearly two costs. One is the operational cost to ICE to provide the training and the training facility. The other one is for the municipality, and that has always been born out of the agency, and that is the salary and benefits of the individuals that are placed in the training for the five-week period. But as it currently stands right now, and in my discussion with Mr. Pena, there is no, certainly he wasn't aware, and I'm not aware of any place in the country where a city has paid ICE to have the training provided for their personnel.
Are they object? The letter requests whether we could, and the other thing is under number point number five is if the city of Mesa pays for the training, will Mesa be eligible for reimbursement if federal funding becomes available later? Is the other question, which could be a congressional action on our part or some other type of lobbying to reinstitute that type of training. And then my last question, obviously, is when can the training begin? How soon can we do this if it's available at Mesa's cost, if, in fact, we get a figure that this council is comfortable living with? I'm a little surprised you indicate that there's no financial benefit to Mesa to find out early on in the booking process whether someone would be in the country illegally. I thought that could be expedited so we could deport instead of having to incarcerate.
Well, you have to remember that we do not incarcerate anyone here, and also anyone that is being held. Once ICE places a hold for immigration status, the federal government picks up the detention cost. The cost to the city would be if you have people that are trained and you're conducting the investigation. We're looking at the models that are being followed around the country, and at a detention facility, it takes somewhere between an hour and 2 hours of additional time to do the processing, to do the assessment of whether you have someone here that is illegally, and then to begin the paperwork process. If you're talking about people doing it from the field, if you take it an investigation sort of a cradle to grave from the vehicle stop or the initial stop all the way through the booking process, it runs between 3 and 6 hours. Generally, that will be a cost that is going to be paid by the city, and you're going to be adding arrest activities by officers as they're engaging in this new activity. This is an added responsibility that is not there currently today. Also, if we determine that we want to have 287G coverage at our detention facility 24/7, then we have to ensure that we have people that are fully trained and that are there all the time. That would probably be around 7 people that would have to be trained and available in order to have that around-the-clock cost. I don't think anyone would suggest that adding new arrest authority to a police agency will lower the operational cost, because anytime you're arresting more people, you're engaging in additional law enforcement activity. Now, if you're taking it conceptually to another place, what is the cost of illegal immigration in general? I'm not qualified to speak to that.
Mayor, but I do think this is the issue. Now, it's hard to put a cost on public safety, but what it does do, though, and Chief can maybe needs to elaborate on this, it provides for us, the city, and the police department another tool that we don't have available today to determine who it is that we've arrested. So this when we're coming into the detention facility, I think what I'm hoping that this will achieve, as we talked about from the very beginning, was allowing our officers to be more effective in knowing who it is that they have in front of them, and being able to then access databases, I guess, is what it is, or other resources, so that we can be more effective in taking the criminal element off the streets of Mesa. And ultimately, I mean, I think we can all argue if we're more effective in that than we do, there is an improvement of cost. I think the issue of effort, there may be more effort. The resources that we'll now dedicate to this and effort may not necessarily be less for the city, but on the same time, if we're able to find out who someone is and find out maybe they've committed crimes in other areas and make that arrest now sooner than waiting for them to come back around the second time and commit an offense, you know, there is definitely cost savings. Now, Chief, is that, I mean, this tool is going to be make it more effective for the police department really to identify who it is that they have and to deal with them in the detention facility. Is that correct?
Well, not necessarily to identification of who the person is. I mean, we currently, once we fingerprint someone and run it through the process, if they have been fingerprinted before and that information is available in one of our criminal databases, we're going to find out who they are. What this does for us is allows to proceed into a different follow line of questioning to determine whether they're here legally or not. It's not whether we know who they are or not. If they are here illegally and they have never been arrested before, still when we do a fingerprint run, we're not going to know who they are. And they can still give us a fictitious name, and we would not know whether they are who, in fact, they're saying they are. But we will be able to develop the reasonable suspicion on the probable cause to assess whether it is more likely than not that this individual is here illegally, and then process them accordingly. This has nothing to do with identifying the person. The identification is a separate process, and it has to do with whether they have identification or not, and then whether we do fingerprints or not, or some other biometric assessment.
It allows the officer to ask questions and go down a process that they currently can't do today.
Well, it gives them the training, correct, training. To be able to, and frankly, what it does more than anything else, I mean, we're asking the question today if whether they're here legally or not. That question is being asked. It's important to understand what it allows us to do is to begin the process of the paperwork in order to facilitate ICE to conduct their investigation and follow through a deportation process. It has nothing to do with us asking whether they're here legally or not. We're asking that question of everyone that gets booked through our jail facility today. That is state law. And it also has nothing to do with whether we're going to fingerprint someone or not. What it does do for us, it allows us to complete or begin the process of the paperwork and the processing to help ICE in their deportation process.
Tom.
Thank you, Mayor. I support this effort. I want to talk a little bit about the letter, but the idea here is not just train, but to deputize so that the Mesa police officers, the Mesa detention officials who are in the facility, and I'll talk about on the street in a minute, but in the facilities, they can begin the process of the paperwork that gets ICE involved quicker, more efficiently, more effectively. Everybody benefits. It makes perfect sense because we're not really taking assets away from crime fighting on the streets, which is why I voted against the thing in August of last year, because I didn't want the 3 to 6 hour time commitment from our officers on the street, but I think an hour to an hour and a half commitment from detention facility officers is an appropriate function. I think the 6 questions that you have written in this letter need to be answered not by Chief Gascon and not by our discussion, but by the federal government in writing. So I think it's important to send this letter with these questions, and I don't think any federal agency has been funded for this fiscal year because they're still working on continuing resolutions, so we don't really know. Congress has never passed a budget there, at least this year. So I support sending the letter. I will tell you that I think the first sentence of the last paragraph is gratuitous and unnecessary under these circumstances. There just isn't any reason to take another slap at Congress. I think we've slapped them around about as frequently and as often as we can. I just don't see a need to do that again in this letter. We're trying to actually build a bridge, not take a gratuitous slap. So, but I support sending this letter. I support sending it today. I support any motion that's made to authorize you to do that. If you want to add the sentence that I don't like, that's your prerogative. Your signature is on there, not mine. So
I'd kind of like to leave it in. Scott, then Vice Mayor.
The
I'm going to touch on a comment. I think we're probably over with it, but make a statement anyway. That law enforcement is not a cost recovery proposition and never has been. If it were, we'd be, I mean, there'd be private companies probably trying to provide the service, and the fact that there aren't a whole lot of those just goes to the fact that they can't make any money at it. So I'm not as concerned about not hitting cost. I know we talk about cost recovery a lot here, but when it comes to law enforcement, I'm a little less concerned about that, quite a bit less concerned about that. In the presentation you gave a few months ago, if memory serves, you had talked about our law enforcement officers had made more than 70 contacts, which resulted in the arrest of over 440 illegal immigrants, and those were turned over to ICE for detainment, investigation, deportation. We also have worked to shut down 25 drop houses as well, and this was a few months back. And more recently, you had an operation, the name of this escapes me, but we had you went out and you busted a number of motels that had been catering to the illegals. And the reason I bring this up is one that, of course, that we've actually been doing something in Mesa, and it seems to fly under the radar screen. But also toward this letter and the idea of putting the 287G-trained officers, which I supported before and will again, into the jails is a good idea. Our new bond, I believe, has a new holding facility that will help facilitate this. Is that right?
Well, I mean, we have, we're talking about an arraignment center, which will facilitate certainly the processing of people. We are not, you know, the arraignment center, the goal is actually to be able to process more people that we're processing today, get them in and get them out. Part of that processing, if we have 287G trained officers, obviously will facilitate our ability to determine people that are here illegally and then process them and turn them over to the federal authorities.
So the new facility is part of the infrastructure to help create the capacity to do this. What we need after that is the 287G. So this seems like a natural fit. But
correct.
But I bring these other issues up because I wonder if there may be we shouldn't be looking at, and this is a question that you'll probably need to consider over the coming months, that when this is available, maybe we should train a few more officers beyond just what's going to be in the jails that would be able to help your officers and ICE as we go out and we make these contacts for the 440. Perhaps having a few extra officers trained in the 287G will help release field officers, and we can have just a certain number of other officers go out, freeing up time for your officers to go other duties, and these officers dedicated this. It would also help with the drop houses. It would also help with the investigation as we continue to look at motel users or businesses that cater to illegals, and that might not be a bad idea to see a couple extra officers for this.
Okay, well, mine is jail-specific request today.
And I don't mind that, but I think the idea of a few others as we put this into operation down the road might not be a bad idea, too.
You know, and the one thing I just want to point out that the issue that you raised about the activity that we have had in our dealing with criminal aliens, our numbers actually from that last presentation, they're up, and actually only have numbers since November. It was about 116 incidents, and it's over 500 people that have been arrested that are involved in the illegal smuggling or participating in that process. I think it's important for this council. I hear often the term sanctuary city being thrown very freely when it comes to Mesa. The reality that we're far from being a sanctuary city. We deal with the criminal aspect of illegal immigration very effectively. We probably have arrested more people in the last 11 months that are engaged in the illegal trade than we have had in prior history. We are participating. As a matter of fact, we'll probably be getting around $400,000, $390,000 as part of our participation in an operation that went after businesses in the city that were participating or facilitating a smuggling operation. And the fines that were collected from those businesses, our portion of that is about $400,000. We're also participating in other more significant operations that I'm not at liberty to discuss today, We have had, and I placed an officer within an operation in ICE when I first got here, and that was a first for us, that has been working in some of these major investigations. And when we go after gangs and some other illegal activities, again, we look at that aspect. As a matter of fact, we did a major gang roundup several weeks ago. About 10% of those people were here illegally. The other 90% were U.S. citizens, but nevertheless, we assessed who was here illegally, and we handled them accordingly. So I think it's important, at least for this council, certainly when you go around the community, to understand that we're far from being a sanctuary city. The contrary is the case. And so I think that the two programs, though, the 287G training for the field and the one for detention facility, they are different programs. They're different requirements. And frankly, your liability also starts to increase significantly once you start enforcing immigration laws at the patrol level without direct supervision from ICE and without a lot of other safety mechanisms. And the jails is a very confined, is a very straightforward process. They are there because we had a legal reason to have them in our jail facility, and then we can continue the process of determining whether they're here legally or not. We have been very successful dealing with the smuggling operations that we're currently structuring in the field without having 287G trained people in the field.
Okay, I've got comments by the Vice Mayor and then back to Scott. I appreciate the participation that you've done with ICE on some of the drop houses and the rest around the city of Mesa. I would call to your attention, if I could, though, a March 18th, 2004 Mesa Police Field manual statement by the prior chief, Dennis Dona. Could you please update that to your current, what you're doing currently? I'm not sure you're familiar with that, but.
I'm vaguely familiar. The policy that I believe that you're referring to is a policy. The city actually began this process in the early 1990s, and the current policy has been an evolution of that. And as you well pointed out, it preceded my administration.
Yeah. The prior policy is not what we're doing today, and I think we should update it. Okay. Vice Mayor?
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to make a motion that we approve your letter as written. I have no heartburn over your sentence that's in the last paragraph. And in fact, as I've reflected over the last, did you want to second my motion, Kyle, before
well,
I go
I
on?
Well, I will, but
okay. As a matter of fact, I've been reflecting when we had that vote previously, we still had some hopes that the federal government was going to address this issue. And as I've reflected the last couple of months about why they haven't, what occurs to me is that the policy-making body, which is Congress, actually benefits from the current policy because, you know, in terms of accruing more money into the Social Security system, the numbers I've heard have been that, like, you have, like, 3 to 5 years extended life of the Social Security system as a result of the current, you know, what I call the don't ask, don't tell policy that they kind of have in place here. And the costs occur to the county, the state, and the cities. And so you have a disconnect between the policymakers and the actual costs that are involved here. And so I think that might be why, you know, things aren't moving forward. So anyway, I'm in favor of this. I just want to thank you, Chief, because I think you have sent a huge message that criminals are not welcome in Mesa. And I think you've sent it over and over again, and I think you're really going after those gangs. And I appreciate that. I call that the hunt for Red October because I can never remember, but I think you guys actually called that Black Autumn or something. You come up with these names for these things that you do. But that was, you know, going out there and getting a message out to the gangs, the gang people, we don't want you. You know, we don't want you whether you're a legal resident of this country or whether you're illegally in the country. We don't want you. We don't want you in Mesa. And then you brought ICE in to work along with you side by side. And you got, I believe, 9 people who were gang-related, who were illegally in the country, and you dealt with that with ICE. So I want you to know how much I appreciate that. I would take a little bit of exception with your analysis on the cost, because it seems to me that if we identify someone as being somebody illegally in the country, if it takes, you know, an hour or two of time, but we transfer the cost of their jailing over to ICE, then you might actually end up with a net zero on in terms of the actual cost of it. You know, I don't think that that's, I would agree with Scott. We don't assess public safety in terms of whether or not it's revenue neutral or whether or not, you know, we can offset costs. We, you know, public safety is job one. But I do have a question, which is, you know, when we're going out and looking for people to hire, I wonder if, you know, somebody's already 287G trained. Do they have to be trained again when they're an employee of the city of Mesa, or can we look for some folks if you've got vacancies at the jail? You know, list is one of the things. If you've got 287G training, maybe you get a hiring bonus or something, because in terms of the cost of taking them out of service and all of those things, it could be a benefit to us.
You have to remember, this is a fairly new process in law enforcement. Again, I want to emphasize, because I think it's important for you to understand the scope. There are about 17,000 law enforcement agencies in this country. There is a handful that are currently trained, and there is about 80 that are waiting to be trained. It is not a national movement to have municipal policing trained on 287G. Obviously, it's a forefront issue in Arizona, but it's important to understand the scope of this. I don't think there is a marketplace that you're going to find 287G trained people that are. It's a very small group of people, very small.
So you're thinking that we don't have somebody sitting in Oklahoma looking at that ice up on the trees and saying, wow, I'd really like to be in Arizona right now?
It's unlikely. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not there. In fact, we could probably hire from some local agencies that are having their own budgetary problems. But again, the numbers are very small.
Okay, thank you.
Scott and Kyle?
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt to throw it on the announcement, though. A little extra. Actually, I did have one thing specific, Chief. You gave us some new numbers, I guess end-of-year numbers for the number of contacts, arrests, dropouts. Can I get that in a memo? I'm sure the rest, everybody would probably want that.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Brady and I have been discussing, we're going to put a package together. Those are the latest numbers that I got from ICE. I'm still waiting for a little more specificity in scenarios, and we are putting a package together that I hope to have ready by sometime in the middle of next week. So you will get it.
Yeah, I would like to have that. Also, for the letter, I kind of agree with Tom. I agree with the statement, but I'm not so sure we want to kick them in the shin while we're asking them for money. But I'm going to leave that also to the mayor. So that's I'm not going to make too much of that. I'm just thinking if we're asking them for make the program available, it would be nice to at least pretend we like the Democratic Congress. Okay. we got it. And as far as the last very quick comment, as far as putting folks in the field, I think given some of the activities that you're doing with the contacts, drop houses and the operation, for example, the hotels that may be having some of those extra, again, I'm pushing for those, a few extra people to be trained, that those investigators that help with that process and are a bridge between our officers and ICE, it might actually be useful, but again, I'm going to save that for a later discussion.
Kyle?
In regard to the letter, I am in agreement with the last paragraph. In fact, I probably would have made it stronger, but that's just because of my experience the last few years when dealing with immigration issues at National League of Cities and trying to get Congress off their tail. But so I think that's a very tone approach. Calm approach to what I probably would have said, personally. So I'm in support of that letter and moving it forward as is.
All right, Councilmember Truitt, you want to weigh in on this? Okay. We have a motion on this. I believe we
do. Yes, I moved.
And
you have
motion
second,
and second for approval. Do you have me sign the letter and send it out? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes unanimously. Tom.
On this issue, one of the things that might help, and I don't know how we do this administratively, but if we have somebody that we arrest and then our court set a bond on them and they're incapable of posting the bond, so they're in custody, we pay for it. Then we do this process and ICE puts a hold on them. We probably need to bring that person back and release him OR so that he's not being held on our bond. Because if he's being held on our bond, we have to pay for it. But if we can get him back into our court, get him released OR, he doesn't get released because of the ICE hold, and so then ICE has to pay for him.
You know, and we'll certainly look into this, but one of the problems that we're having, frankly, and kind of sort of speaks to your the issue that you raised, and we have to be careful. Frankly, in the eagerness of some people in this region to put people on the bus to go across the state line, sorry, not the state line, to go across the line into Mexico, we have been already negatively impacted with people that are wanted for serious criminal events that we are investigating, and these people are being deported before we conduct our investigation. Actually, we have lost an investigative tool. They have returned within a short period of time to go back and commit the same level of crime. So it's really important to understand that, you know, sometimes putting somebody in, you know, ICE will gladly put anybody in that bus that they can, send them across the line. And if these are people that we want to make sure that they pay the price for the crimes they're committing here, we got to pay that price. And we got to be thoughtful about this process, because once they go across, if they're, quite frankly, if they're criminals, they're going to come back within a short period of time. But we many times lose the connectivity that we had to the bigger investigation that we have more interest in.
And Chief, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that we administratively, for people that we've arrested and we are holding for the commission of a crime, and we've got a bail on them, it's my understanding of the court system that they're probably still going to be our responsibility as so long as they're being held on our bond.
We'll take a look at it.
If ICE picks it up, even if they're on our bond, if they start paying the cost, then we don't need to do anything. But if they don't start picking up the cost until he's going to be released, and then they're responsible for holding him, because he's in jail on our charge initially. Sure. But if he is being held on our charge, they're not paying the cost until that disposition, let's just release him OR, not dismiss the charges.
Got it.
Just to release him for us so then they can pick up the dime earlier. I don't want to release anybody. I just want to shift the cost.
We'll look into that with the court.
Okay, thank you.
Vice Mayor.
I'd like to make the point, Councilmember Whelan isn't here, but he would have voted for this had he been here. He has been urging us to move forward with this on this also. And I don't know, Mayor, you know, I made it as is. Would you like the rest of us to sign this along with you? We're fine with your just signing it, but if you think that it would be meaningful, I know that we would all... Well, I shouldn't say that. I think we would all be okay with it. I'm looking at Mr. Rawls. He may not feel that way.
Might have to modify one paragraph.
If you think it would be better for the city to have all of us sign it, I will sign it as is. If you think it's just as powerful with you, you can do it however you choose.
The first draft was with everybody's signature, but then I thought, nah, I may have to cross out a few. So I thought maybe 5-2, it'll still go out. So I would like to have everyone's signature if they wouldn't mind doing that.
In that
I think
case,
it's a stronger
you'll
message.
Have to put the comma after 2007 then, because it needs to be grammatically correct.
Okay, I'll work on that. Yeah.
Mayor, do you need a revised motion in order to reflect that? Because I said as is in the motion.
Why don't we do that and then include Councilmember Whelan.
Okay, let me restate that motion then, or I don't know how you want us to do it legally, Ms. Spinner, but an amended motion that we would then add everyone's signatures to this letter.
Okay. All right, motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Passes. Item number five, then, is appointment to boards and committees.
Move for approval with a comment, Mayor.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to note that Mr. Parker and one of his partners in the CPA firm, which recently located in Mesa, came to me before they actually came to Mesa, and they wanted to be part of the community. They wanted to have opportunities to be involved. They wanted to be part of the charitable community. I don't know that I have, in my time serving on the City Council, seen a business that has come so early on wanting to be part of the fabric of Mesa. And so I just, you know, want to say that, you know, welcome to Mesa. Thanks for jumping in.
Okay. I have a motion and second for approval. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Number six, acknowledging receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. Have three. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. The reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Any updates? Scott.
I went to two meetings this past week. One was the East Valley Partnership meeting. Businesses from the entire East Valley. We heard a nice presentation from DMB on their plans, and I think they got the same reaction there as we had here or in some other of our meetings, which was a lot of silence and, wow, big plans, a little quite a bit to absorb. So it wasn't a negative response. It was just there's so much in this plan and what's going to happen with Williams Gateway. But East Valley Partnership is taking a lead in some of the studies here. They've been certainly partners with us for a long time, and they are taking continued interest in the future of this area. And I'm sure they'll be interested in watching Channel 11 to see what we discussed here today. And I also was at a meeting at the state level of the Homeland Security Coordinating Council, which I am on. Mesa will be receiving some grant money. We have $17 million coming to the state, and additional dollars this year will be coming in from Homeland Security issues. Mesa will be receiving some of those funds as well for projects that I feel will not only directly affect Homeland Security, but also general public safety and education as well. So.
Okay, Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. Last night I was at Lehigh School for a meeting of the residents of the area around North Country Acres with representatives from the State Mining Office, State Inspection, Mine Inspector's Office, and Alan Sanderson was there from Transportation. The issue of mining up there on the CMEX mining on a couple of different properties there is very important to those people who live there. They're feeling fairly harmed by not having any information prior to purchasing their homes that was going in. And the conversation was about the reclamation of that mine as they mined it out. But the question was raised at the meeting. They asked if the city had was entering into agreements to mine its property up there, and they were very concerned that we were. I said, we have not done anything about that. Also, I had the opportunity this last weekend to participate in the Household Hazardous Waste event. I got to wear a cool slicker in the pouring rain and cold, and it was one of the most fun things I have done since I've been on the city council. I'm not kidding. I am not making that up. I had a great time as people were coming in time after time saying that they appreciated the city having this event. They really are glad that we do it. I had people who said, can we do it more than once a year? And I pointed out that the materials that they had just been handed showed them it was four times a year, and they were just thrilled. And it was, you know, sometimes you just hear the negative things that are going on, but I have to tell you, I had people say, well, would you please thank the council? So on behalf of those people, thank you to the council for the Household Hazardous Waste event.
Okay. There was a 10 of the TPC meeting yesterday, and one of the issues was $20 million worth of sound walls for existing neighborhoods along freeway corridors that meet certain attenuation levels, and they're going to be ranking those. It was now they're also doing a potential, because Glendale made a request for $9 million on reimbursement of a wall they built for a neighborhood because at the time it didn't qualify for ADOT's construction costs. So I'd like the city staff to take a quick peek at Mesa's sound walls and attenuation measures to see if we want to submit anything for consideration also along those lines. So we'll get you briefed a little bit more on that. It opened up a new a can that I didn't think would get open, but as long as there's an opportunity there, let's take a look. About $17 million worth of submittals were made, plus Glendale's $9 million, so there's some money out there that maybe we can take a look at. Okay, anybody else? Scott?
I neglected one, Mayor. I'm sorry. It was a quick contact with a constituent in the area in Sunlands Village East. Apparently they had a sewer break. Contacted a number of entities. It was they couldn't get anybody out there. This is over the weekend when it was raining. They contacted the city, who was out there in the rain. They said 15 minutes. They say it took us 15 minutes to get there. The fire department would be proud. 15 minutes to get there. They stood there in the rain, made the repair. So Jack, kudos to that department.
Okay. Next item is scheduling of meetings and general information. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. We remind the members of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee meeting that you have a meeting following the study session today.
5 minutes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. and we will be having the workshops on the Gateway Strategic Plan. We'll be out at ASU today, starting here in about 5 minutes, going through the evening, and then tomorrow morning till about noon, out at ASU Polytechnic. And then, just my council, we have a council meeting on Monday, the 17th. We'll have a brief study session prior to. Then we have a following Thursday, December 20th, will be the last council meeting of the year. So look forward to that. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Any questions? All right. That is it. No speakers. All right. All in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye.
All right. Study session is adjourned.